Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin, executive editor at the Mises Institute. And this week we're going to talk a bit about military spending and all of those wars that are still going on and with apparently no end in sight that I can see, and maybe with new added wars to come, which I console myself saying, well, there's no way they're going to be able to, like, do boots on the ground in any of these situations. But we'll talk about that. And to talk about that, I brought on Zachary Yost. If you're a regular listener, you, of course, know Zachary as one of our foreign policy guys that I bring on to talk about this. And he's worked with a variety of organizations, has a pretty solid background in foreign policy research, has a number of columns at Mises.org, so look up his archive. And I just really wanted to talk a bit about war funding, about all this talk about Iran, possible conflict there, acceleration and bombing of the Houthis next to the Red Sea, and of course, we won't talk much about it, but the Ukraine war is still there. That hasn't gone anywhere. So, of course, you'll remember this president. Somebody posted a clip. I was looking at Twitter today, and it was Trump going on and on about how stupid it was to be involving the U.S. in a war with the Houthis, and you don't have to bomb these people, and it's all so stupid. And the comment was, what happened to this guy? Candidate Trump was talking about how dumb all these wars were. Now he's ratcheting them up, which, of course, if you're me, you are not surprised in the slightest. Like, this is what happens. That's George W. Bush ran on a humble foreign policy. And, of course, hey, 9/11 happens, so how convenient. We can just don't even have to pretend that we're doing that anymore. Obama ran on getting the U.S. out of various wars, didn't do any of that, and, in fact, started new war with Libya, got the U.S. involved, and started a minor occupation in Syria. There's another thing we could talk about. So all this is going on. So just to get the discussion started then, Zach, I just want to point out that both Trump and his Secretary of Defense were bragging about how coming up next year, they're going to have a $1 trillion defense budget. And this is something to be very, very excited about. Now, I went in and I ran the numbers. So on an inflation-adjusted basis, so obviously on a non-inflation-adjusted basis, a $1 trillion defense budget is a huge increase and well above anything that we saw during the Cold War, during the Reagan years, even during all that surge stuff. If you're old enough to remember that, the surge in Iraq and escalation in Afghanistan and all of that stuff, that all maxed out below $1 trillion. But if you adjust it for inflation, it's even then a $1 trillion budget is the highest. The closest it comes is $999 billion. That is at the tail end of all that surge and all that, hey, we're going to win in Afghanistan and Iraq. That was in 2010. They, of course, ended up losing those wars, did not achieve their objectives. And both those countries are basket cases now, thanks to the U.S. involvement there, at great cost to Americans, great cost to the American taxpayer. And now they're talking about another increase, which would be, so jacking it up to $1 trillion would be a 12% increase. Now, that's not the biggest increase ever, but it is the biggest increase since 2004. So during the Iraq war. So big, big increase. And what for? Of course, as we know, the Pentagon hasn't passed an audit ever. This was, of course, something that MAGA was talking about. Hey, let's get DOGE working on the Pentagon. Let's make them pass an audit. Suddenly, you don't hear about that anymore. In fact, if anything, MAGA is cheering on massive new increases in spending, even though we still have no idea what the Pentagon is spending its money on. So my question for you, Zach, is what is the $1 trillion defense budget necessary? What should they spend it on? I mean, I think we've talked about this before, how the U.S. basically views every square inch of planet Earth as a potential place for U.S. intervention. But when you saw, what was your reaction? Let's just ask that. What was your reaction when you saw that they were going, that they were bragging about a coming $1 trillion defense budget? What does that mean to you? What does that mean to you?
Yeah. I've come down from my heady days of the first few weeks of the administration when Doge was ripping and tearing, as they say. It was quite disappointing because in the first few weeks, Trump was like, we should talk to Russia and China and cut our defense spending in half. And I was like, I don't know if that will happen, but boy, this is good to hear. And so on the same level, who knows if this $1 trillion will happen? It could just be talk, but no, we don't need it. We should be slashing the defense budget. We spend more than like half we spend more than the rest of the world combined or close to it, something like that. And our biggest potential rivals, like Russia and China, spend way less. And when you get into the weird accounting chicanery and everything, China's military spending accounts for things that aren't counted for our military spending. And if that was factored in, would be even larger, like huge amounts of the Chinese military is used basically for domestic law enforcement because they're, you know, an oppressive state. They have something like 1 million troops are guarding their border and maintaining internal security. We don't have that here.
Well, and you'll remember, talked about this book before, right? Unrivaled.
That, right. Yes. That's where I got that from. Yes. Michael Beckley.
Well, and he talked about how there's China has something like 14 different border disputes, both land and maritime, with surrounding countries. Back when good Trump arises, Trump talks about how, hey, we've got two beautiful oceans. Remember that comment? The United States has two beautiful oceans surrounding it. So we just don't need all that stuff from NATO and everything. Well, apparently, he forgot about that because I guess the U.S. needs a lot more spending now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a very big Monroe Doctrine guy, I think. And I mean, in that sense, I'm in favor of American retrenchment, you know, pulling back from our obligations in the other half of the world. The United States is in a terrible position in all sorts of ways. The debt is exploding and we risk a debt trap. The interest on the debt is larger than the defense budget. At home, domestically, you know, the vital mediating institutions of society are decaying. I mean, I don't know if I'm being overly pessimistic about the present time, sort of a present bias, but I'm not sure of another time in history where there was so like where the non-state aspect of society was so degraded and in a rotten state. So we have all these problems. We can't afford to be doing all this stuff elsewhere, either monetarily or socially. And some people just don't get that message. I've actually become sort of long-term less optimistic for the continuance of the United States under its current constitutional order. Not that the United States will go away, but as part of that, I do have a little hope that foreign policy might improve some, despite what we're going to talk about today. One being just the realities, the fiscal realities, and the coming sort of aging population. It's going to get expensive to do all this stuff, although technology might affect that as well. Future is radically uncertain. But also within the administration, there's now a fighting chance. There, you know, it's been around long enough now that we can sort of see the sides have, you know, taken their corners. There's neocon light, or maybe just neocon. And I think probably one of the biggest people there is Mike Waltz. And then in the other corner is the retrenchment people, you might say, realist restrainers. I think that Vice President Vance, very much in that corner. I hated the whole Signalgate thing. That was just a disaster. But it was nice to read him say, you know, 4% of U.S. shipping goes through the Suez Canal, 40% of European shipping does. Why are we bothering with this? Also, of course, Tulsi Gabbard. And I want to bring to listeners' attention a positive development there. Will Ruger, who I worked under for a time, was just named the Deputy Director for National Intelligence. He is a very solid, restraint-oriented person, and he will now be in charge of preparing Trump's intelligence briefs. So this is quite a high ground to secure in all of the national security bureaucratic knife fighting going on in the hallways. I also think that Witkoff is also pretty solid. So I think we're seeing this fighting taking place, and I think that Trump, whether intentionally or not, is sort of standing above it, watching it happen and playing both sides. I have no idea. But there's a little hope, but lots of bad things to continue on the way to a potentially less bad future.
Well, they're doing less bad things without stopping the more bad things. And what I mean by that is, right, when I watch all this saber rattling around the Panama Canal, or all this totally ham-fisted way of going about Greenland, I could see like a way of bringing Greenland into the orbit of the United States very closely, but the way they're going about it is just pretty embarrassing. Really, Vance flies in and thinks he's going to go on some grand tour and nobody wants to talk to him, right? Whoever planned the Vance trip to Greenland didn't do a great job. But when I see the stuff like Greenland and Panama and all that, I'm like, well, that would be an improvement if the Greenland and Panama thing were replacing the obsession with the Middle East. I would say, okay, that would be an improvement. That would be a form of retrenchment, because at least the United States is then concentrating on areas that you could conceivably claim have an actual application to U.S. territorial defense. But they're doing that in addition. They're doing all this garbage with Panama and Greenland without withdrawing from Ukraine or the Middle East. In fact, they're getting U.S. involvement there to greater and ever higher and more violent levels. And so I think we can just move on to that, where, right, you just mentioned Signalgate, which, right, for if you're not following this stuff closely, this was that whole conflict, which I actually didn't follow very closely in any of the details, where supposedly, and I don't know if this was on purpose or not, they accidentally shared the signal discussion, accidentally maybe, this discussion among White House people and shared it with a reporter from The Atlantic. So the idea was, oh, they're sharing national secrets and all of this stuff. And I didn't really care that much about the details, although the point you make about Vance's comment, assuming that was like an actual private conversation, that's very promising that he would point that out, because it leads directly to the discussion about the Houthis, right? What is the context here on the Houthis? So Trump claimed that, oh, we have to bomb the Houthis because they're disturbing Red Sea traffic, Red Sea shipping, which, as Vance pointed out, as you just noted, is like 4%. It has very little effect on U.S. trade, very much unlike the Panama Canal. Also, the U.S. has tons and tons of trade just come straight from Asia to the western coast of the United States. Remember those two beautiful oceans? And so the U.S. has plenty of ways to get access to international trade. So the U.S. is now going to involve itself in a war with the Houthis over Red Sea trade, which is far more central, to Asia-Europe trade. And swell. I never believed that, though, because the whole Houthi thing, right? Houthis are allies, the rebels, they're allies of Iran. And the U.S. policy for a long, long time has been side with the Saudis, the blood-soaked Saudi despots who are close allies of the United States and MAGA. I guess MAGA loves the dictators of Saudi Arabia. And I just might note, by the way, the leaders of Saudi Arabia have never ruled legitimately, right? They were just like a little house of barbarians and people living in huts who helped the British win World War I in kind of the side theaters in Arabia. And the British said, oh, okay, we'll give you your own country. So they helped the Saudis get their own country. And so they've ruled as the dictators ever since. They never did anything to actually deserve that position. other than curry favor with the Brits. So it's always been just this illegitimate regime of garbage human beings. But apparently they're very close allies of the United States. Best personal friends with the Bush family, who you'll remember George W. Bush walking around holding hands, literally, with the king of Saudi Arabia back during the Iraq War. And so the U.S. has been doing the bidding of the Sauds for a long, long time. And part of what the Sauds like is to keep peace with Israel and to make war on Iran, because Iran is basically their rival in the region. So it seemed to me this was always just obviously another attempt to curry favor with the Saudis and, of course, with the Israelis, who hate Iran also and anyone allied with Iran, i.e. The old Syrian regime, which, those horrible old Syrians who used to run Syria now have been replaced with basically ISIS terrorists. The Israelis like that, and the U.S. apparently likes that. And so this is just the latest step, then, is we don't like the Houthis because they're allied with Iran, and maybe we can replace them with some sort of friend of the Saudi regime, which, you know, will engage in the usual mass murder that Saudis like. So it's just the usual horrible policies of the U.S. in the Middle East, which has nothing to do with the U.S. defense and everything to do with the state of Israel. At least that's my take on the situation. So don't believe for a second it has anything to do with the Red Sea, but you probably have some additional observations on that.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't really anything new. I mean, going back to, like, I don't know, 2015, 2016, or maybe even before that, it's just bombing the Houthis will not work. People have been doing it for over a decade at this point. Before the Saudis were doing it, and we were facilitating that bombing. And that didn't really get anywhere.
I have a statistic here for you. Since 2002, the United States has carried out nearly 400 strikes in Yemen. So, yeah, it's like more than a 20-year thing, really, at this point.
Yeah, well, and so those earlier strikes were against Al-Qaeda and the Arabian Peninsula. These later strikes, so for context here, Yemen is sort of a cobbled-together state. There used to be North Yemen and South Yemen, and they have a long history of how they came to be together. And there's actually a Shia, a sizable Shia population. I'm blanking on the specific name. And that's sort of how they have a connection to Iran. The Arab Spring happened, and the, you know, president who'd been president for, you know, who knows how many decades, he got kicked out. The Houthis, you know, had an uprising. I'm blanking on all the details 10 years ago now. The president, you know, sort of moved to the south, and then the Saudis and I think the Arab Emirates were involved. And then he split with them and he returned to the north and allied with the Houthis. And so the Houthis have, you know, every so often they bombed a Saudi oil field and things. And there used to be Emirati troops and Saudi troops, I think, in Yemen. I don't know how much that is anymore. But as soon as the Saudis stopped bombing Yemen, it seemed we took up the slack. And a big, big impetus was this was the Houthis came out sort of as champions of Gaza, and they've launched a few missiles at Israel. And the big thing is they started attacking shipping in the Red Sea. And we've been bombing these people for 10 years. I have no idea what anyone expects this to accomplish. To defeat them, you'd have to send in an expeditionary force, and that's, you know, extremely expensive. Who knows if it even worked that well? I mean, you can't run these sort of things how we ran Iraq and Afghanistan. You'd have to be extremely brutal, all that. So I'm not recommending this by any means. I'm just saying this is what you'd have to do. And to get back to what we were just saying, why? Who cares? The Red Sea is not a strategic interest for us. And there's lots of people in the neighborhood who could do something about it. Egypt's lost billions of dollars, and I've seen, it might have been in the Signal chat, I can't remember now, or it might have just been speculation in the press, about like, oh, you know, Egypt's losing all this money, we're going to have, yeah, this wasn't in the Signal chat, but Egypt's losing all this money, maybe the U.S. will have to kick them some extra. And it's like, what? that's crazy. And just to drive home how absurd the situation is, a few months ago, there was a German frigate, I guess out in Asia, I don't know where it was, returning home to Germany. And it opted to go around the Cape of Good Hope rather than through the Red Sea. This is a German military vessel avoiding the Red Sea. Germany is a wealthy country, and they could take care of this, but they're literally running thousands of miles out of the way to avoid it. It's outrageous, and Trump needs to snap out of it, kick all those people out of the admin who think this is important, because there's not any conceivable way it is.
Well, you know, you talk about how bombing the Houthis doesn't seem to have much much effect, and it would require an expeditionary force. So it seems, though, that the administration wants to pivot to bombing Iran. And I'm not sure what that would accomplish. Now, of course, if you follow social media discussion, saying, oh, of course, the U.S. could defeat Iran in weeks. But, okay, what does defeat mean? I mean, surely you could say the same thing about Yemen, right? I mean, a tiny little country, you can bomb the hell out of it, and they're still attacking ships in the Red Sea, still bombing stuff in Saudi Arabia. And so maybe a war with Iran isn't quite as cut and dry as all of that, which is a country many, many times larger with better infrastructure than Yemen. And of course, is it a good idea to back Iran into like a tiny little corner and then just hope it all works out for the best? But that seems to be what the administration is talking about. Now, at the goading of the State of Israel, they want military action against their nuclear power plants and any place where they might be enriching uranium. And there's all this talk about how Iran is closer to building a bomb and all this stuff, which it may very well be. And if I were Iran, I'd want a bomb too. Because if history has shown anything, it's that the United States doesn't bomb countries that have nuclear weapons. And I just look at the situation and I see how the administration refuses to put anything off the table in terms of full-scale war with Iran. And there's just a lot of delusional Americans who think this would be no big deal. And just remember, the U.S. lost its wars with Iraq and Afghanistan. So those were countries starting out from a much poorer and lesser position than Iran. So I just wonder what the end game is there. Is this just all pure politics to somehow keep the Israelis happy so they can say, hey, we're gonna not let the Israelis, or we're not gonna let the Iranians get a bomb, which is fine in terms of that would just be the status quo. I'm not in favor of U.S. meddling there at all. But if you're not taking full-scale war off the table, that just seems to me like you're setting yourself up for a very terrible outcome and position. But I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, another very delusional crusade at the moment. I really, everything is summed up by reading somewhere in the media, someone said something about like Libya and Muammar Gaddafi, how we got rid of his weapons of mass destruction program in like the mid-2000s. And I'm like, oh my goodness, this is the last thing you want to bring up. What happened to him? You know, he was just literally killed and desecrated in the street while Hillary Clinton was cackling. So don't want to bring that up. But I feel like this is a point where there's a tug of war within the administration, because I know there's people there who are fully aware this would be nuts, this would be crazy, disastrous, not in our interest. And then there's people who seem to think it's a good idea. And Trump, you know, who knows what Trump is thinking, but I randomly tuned into the last bit of his press conference with Bukele yesterday. And he said something that struck me as remarkable, just at least in a shift in tone from decades of U.S. policy, which is like, I want, he said, I want Iran to be great and rich and wealthy. They just can't have a bomb. You know, they can be a great country, but if they have the bomb, you know, basically he's like, we're going to destroy them. So that's at least a bit of a change in rhetoric from, you know, bomb, 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 Iran, McCain, and people want to just glass the country. But Iran, despite its weakened state, is not going to be a pushover. I mean, it, for one thing, it might be counterproductive to those people who desire to get rid of sort of the ruling modernist theocratic regime there, because it has lost immense support. I mean, it's sort of a case study that those in favor of some sort of theocratic government should look to, because atheism is rampant in Iran. Something like 10,000 mosques have closed. It's shocking, really. The regime has very little support. But what happens when you start bombing people? Rally around the flag. It's, I suppose, possible. It's in the realm of, you know, conceivable things that could happen, that there'd just be an uprising and everything would be happy and great, but I would not bet a penny on that. It's much more likely there'll be more support for the regime. And I don't think that Russia and China would be joining in the war or anything, but it's not in their interest to let Iran be, you know, turned into a crater. It's just inconceivable to put troops on the ground. I mean, I just can't fathom how that would happen. Our military stocks are already greatly depleted. And thanks to us, you know, shoveling free stuff out to Israel and Ukraine. And Iran, you know, is there's some people there who are not complete idiots. So they've had a few decades to prepare for waging a war against the United States should it invade, and what that would entail. And it would, you know, lots of lessons to have been learned from Iraq, which, you know, Iran was helping the Shia militias who were killing Americans for, you know, a decade. Lots of lessons from there, lots of lessons from Afghanistan. It would be a complete disaster. Hopefully the saber rattling is a negotiation tactic. The meeting last Saturday supposedly went well. They're meeting this upcoming Saturday. Hopefully that will go well. It seems that they want, both sides want to do something quickly, and it's just trying to figure out what is feasible, what both sides can accept. And on the enrichment thing, it's, as far as I understand, Iran does not have a literal nuclear weapons program. They're doing what lots of other countries do, which is they're positioning themselves so that should they decide we need the bomb, that they can get it rapidly. Usually 6 months is what I see in the context of like Korea or Japan. Should they go nuclear, people estimate, oh, they could have it ready in 6 months.
And Saudi Arabia has threatened to do something like well.
Yeah, yeah. And I just add another thing. We were talking about the perfidious Saudis and their malign influence. This is an annoying situation where the Saudis and Israel are together in terms of rivaling Iran. So, you know, it's just both of these lobbies have lots of influence and they're combining that to pressure against, you know, us to do something about Iran. So.
Yeah, the whole thing's made so much worse by the fact that all of this stuff could be decided on the whims of, like, I don't know, one person, potentially, just the president. And Ron Paul has a great article this week. It's called Standing at the Edge of the Iran War Cliff. And that's the focus of his weekly article this time, is how bizarre is it that people around the world were kind of sitting on the edge of their seats over the weekend, seeing if Trump's special envoy, Witkoff, would decide that, oh yeah, the U.S. should go to war with Iran, or Iran's not going to meet our expectations on this. And then it just comes down to one guy deciding, right? How long ago was it that the United States was a country run by constitutional law where Congress had to determine if you could send troops or bombers to bomb the hell out of another country. And MAGA is so far from anything resembling constitutional government. You can see it out in the fact that they think the president should just be able to decide tax policy, i.e. tariff policy, just on a whim. They don't care about what Article 1 of the Constitution says about that. So why should they care what the Constitution says about the ability to declare war? They apparently don't care and are perfectly fine with Trump's ability to declare war on various countries at a second's notice. He's already can ratchet up new bombing campaigns in various Middle Eastern countries, can become directly involved, as we know the U.S. is, in terms of missile defense and such in the state of Israel's various conflicts. Not to mention putting troops on the ground in Syria and all that stuff. This is all decided by one man. And Trump is just the latest person to do that. And he could just decide, hey, we're going to send some advisors to Iran, probably, I guess, send them to a country neighboring Iran, close to Iran's border, to start interfering there and waging some low-level war until you can escalate it and escalate it until it gets into a full-scale war. That's what they were trying to do in Syria all of those times. And there was an actual occupation force there, a small one. For years, that helped the current terrorists take over Syria. So I could see them trying to do something in Iran as well. But Congress has nothing to do with it. There's going to be no vote. There's going to be no constitutional process whatsoever. And Ron Paul points this out and just how strange it is that people have come around to thinking that this is just a perfectly acceptable thing. It's absolutely no different from the kings of the days of yore just deciding in their privy council who we're going to go war with. And you don't have to consult anybody. That's the way the U.S. is run now. And that's how war with Iran could materialize, or war with any place.
I'd add, though, with the kings, they actually were more restrained than current presidents because they had a fiscal constraint. They were always desperate for money. It was quite a, you know, restraint on them. And, you know, in the England, they had to call Parliament to levy taxes. And that's how, you know, the kings would usually want to wage a war. So they'd call Parliament. Parliament would have extract concessions, yada, yada, yada. So, yeah, today, you know, print the money up. And it was quite amusing. Apparently, like a dozen or so Democrats sent some letter saying, like, oh, Trump has to justify this bombing in Yemen. On what authority is he doing this on? I'm like, okay, that's fine, but this is a decade of policy at this point. Where were you before? I mean, better late than never. And I'd also add here, just to broaden the scope a little bit, that this sort of is how we get, we are down the road to a post-constitutional order, and also a commentary on how a formal constitution, written constitution, is of no value by itself. What is sort of essential is the informal constitution that a people hold within their minds and hearts. And sort of like a good example would be, can't declare war without Congress. But there's lots of things between that, sort of a Zeno's paradox or whatever. It's like, well, is this war? And a good example is the U.S. basically running a center out of Germany, practically directing the Ukrainian war. I forget what that was in, if that was in the New York Times or the Washington Post, quite an illustrative, lengthy piece about how the U.S. has basically been providing oodles of information and guidance and practically, you know, all but ordering Ukrainians what to do. Well, that's not declaring war exactly, but is that within the spirit of what that means? No. And as the U.S. loses more and more, seemingly every election, that sort of constitutional personality, then the continuance of our current constitutional order does not bode well.
Well, you mentioned a moment ago that so much of the saber rattling around the Iran situation is closely connected to just interest group politics, right? We've got two important interests that have joined forces on this issue. The Saudis and the Israelis are together because they both hate Iran and view Iran as a rival. And so the question is that, does American foreign policy really have anything to do with with the defense of U.S. territory, especially in the oil issue now, right? With all this drill, baby, drill stuff coming out of the administration. We already know that the United States isn't deeply reliant on foreign oil. So you can't say that, oh, yes, well, we have to go to war with Iran to protect interests because they might mine the Strait of Hormuz or something. There are so many other sources of oil. And the if the United States didn't insist on being enemies with Russia, it'd have easy access to that oil right there. If the United States didn't insist on being enemies with Venezuela, plenty of oil right there. And but the U.S. may not even need that because of its potential ability to do a lot of drilling. There's, of course, Alaska. There's offshore stuff, which the Trump administration could do a lot on. So there's no reason to even buy the oil argument if you just think that it's worth killing 100,000 foreigners to keep oil cheap. That's, of course, a really cynical way of going about it. You could just say, well, we need to protect our economic interests for oil. But even that doesn't really hold any water these days. So I'm trying to come up with a way that Iran has something to do with U.S. interests, and I'm coming up with nothing. It has everything to do with Saudi and Israeli interests who are lobbying members of Congress to take action here. Explain to me how the U.S. benefits in terms of essential defense of the United States and its people by continuing all of this stuff in the Middle East.
Yeah. The oil we do export is mostly from Canada and Mexico. And amusingly, actually before 2022, Russia was actually one of our largest importers, although it was a tiny, tiny amount. And that is because, you know, I'm no chemist, but there's different kinds of oil, heavy crude and whatnot. And we got some sort of oil from Russia. And then we actually started getting it from Venezuela. I don't know if that has been revoked now or not, but we were retrading with them again. And, you know, as a Western Pennsylvanian, frack, baby, frack, drill, baby, drill. But my cynical thought on why the U.S. cares so much about Iran is twofold. One is just the blatant lobbying and all that, both domestic lobbying from various right-wing groups who think Iran is some sort of, antichrist, who knows, all sorts of things. But also, I think there's some, it seems to me that there's sort of a spiritually boomer obsession with Iran from the embassy hostages. I mean, it seems to me that there are people from back then who have never gotten over that. I mean, it just is beyond outrageous to them that that happened. Understandably, not good. But I mean, it seems that is why they've never gotten over it. They just cannot. Iran is the great Satan, and it the regime must be destroyed. And yeah, I mean, it seems to be a combination of both of those things to some degree.
Well, which was 48 years ago or so, right? Everyone involved is dead or super elderly now. And it does seem like a weird thing to care about anymore. And they call the United States the great state. Who cares? Who cares? They can't, even if they had nukes, they don't have intercontinental ballistic missiles. It would be a problem for Israel for sure. But Israel has nukes. In fact, Israel's the only power in the region with nukes, which, well, as Mearsheimer was recently pointing out, actually destabilizes the region by having one power with nukes and nobody else. So potentially having Iran with nukes would add some stability to the region. Nor would Iran be the first Islamic country, of course, with nuclear weapons. You'll remember a few years ago, Vance was, I don't know if it was a joke or he was trying to make some point. Surely he knew this was factually incorrect when they said that England, the United Kingdom, will be once Muslims become the ruling party of England, that England will be the first Islamist country with nuclear weapons. Now, of course, even England, which looks like just an awful country for a variety of reasons, some of which is immigration driven, they're still a long way from being an Islamist-run country, just in terms of demographics. Nonetheless, even if that were true, let's say 10 years from now, the UK were 70% Islamist, radical Islams, and they all took over the UK and they had access to the UK's nukes. Hi, by then, Pakistan will have been an Islamic, it's called the Islamic Republic of Pakistan, and has had nukes since the late 1990s. So Pakistan's got it. Pakistan's right next to Afghanistan. All it means is the U.S. has to play nice with Pakistan rather than treating it like absolute garbage like the U.S. will do with any country that doesn't have nukes. So it's not, it wouldn't even be a fundamental change to anything in terms of, oh, Islamic country now has nukes. No, they've already had that for, at this point, nearly 30 years. So I just don't see the big change. Again, not a problem for the United States, maybe a problem for the state of Israel, but that's not the United States. And it just seems that that is the driver of so much policy. It'd be a problem for the UK or for the Saudis as well. And the Saudis might then get nukes to counter the Iranians. But again, that would add stability to the region, as has shown through so much nuclear deterrence research for decades. So I just don't see how it's worth it for us at all.
And I would this is sort of tied to Israel as well, but you bring up the UK nuclear force. I was unaware of the extent to which the United States is so involved militarily with these countries. Not, you know, we knew them within NATO, yada, yada, yada. We ship them tons of stuff. But the UK nuclear arsenal is literally maintained by the US. Like the missiles, the warheads have to come to a base in like North Carolina, South Carolina, I don't recall, where they're maintained. And the UK, you know, they only have one nuclear pillar, as it were, which is submarines. Their submarines are way over their service expected lifespan, and it's actually questionable to what degree they always have a sort of immediate strike force available. So that's just a sad commentary on them. I actually would recommend people check out Mark Felton's YouTube channel. Actually, we talked about him before in relation to Ukraine, but ever since there was talk of the UK sending troops to Ukraine, I don't think he ever has directly said anything about politics, but ever since then, he's done a lot of videos on the state of UK military readiness, and it is just, it's a disaster. But similarly, Israel, their entire air force is US-made fighters. And all of these fighters, you know, are extremely delicate instruments, which is potentially problematic in a giant war, but they require U.S. inputs in terms of either training for the technical crews, but definitely in terms of replacement parts. So this, in a way, is something I'd not thought about until recently, in a way in which arms exports can actually tie foreign countries and incentivize them to become very involved in lobbying in the United States, because it's not like we can just say, well, defend yourself. They'll be like, well, we need you to just, you know, to log into the computer, basically. So that's another sort of not great thing to think about going forward.
Yeah, the UK is not France, which my impression of France is that they're, because of whatever reason, right, maybe it's just de Gaulle's influence to this day, They've always been kind of jealous in terms of they've jealously guarded their prerogative in terms of having their own nuclear arsenal, their own nuclear power. They threatened back in the day to leave NATO if the U.S. didn't treat them better and all that sort of thing. The U.K., on the other hand, just does whatever the United States tells it to do.
It's our lapdog at this point. I mean, I actually, it's sort of sad as, you know, a fan of the common law heritage that the UK has bequeathed to us. I actually think France is the best positioned to make it in the long run. Amusingly, this is another Mark Fountain video I recommend checking out. His video on Fort Knox, where he's basically like, if they do audit that, a ton of that gold's going to be from the UK. I did not realize the extent to which we squeezed the UK prior to the implementation of Lend-Lease. We made them pay cash in the form of gold. And potentially that was the beginning of the end for them. I don't know. But yeah.
That was back when the U.S. was demanded some payment for all the free stuff it was given to foreign countries.
I mean, my personal preference, you know, I mean, I don't think these places have much gold these days, is we get preferential picks from, you know, the British Museum and the Louvre and the Berlin Museum. You know, the Ishtar Gate would look quite good somewhere in Washington, I think. That's how I'm in favor of making these places pay, cash and carry only. But I don't think my view will be adopted anytime soon.
Well, I wouldn't be shocked if something happened in London where all these museums got looted and destroyed somehow, just given the absolute inability of the instruments of maintaining civil order to function properly in the UK. It doesn't seem to be working very well there. Like, if you want to see a place where just basic institutions just seem to be breaking down a variety of ways and not producing the wealth necessary to even fund them because their economic situation has become so dire, that just seems to be the UK. So it just seems to be pretty irrelevant, I suppose, to the whole equation in terms of geopolitics.
Other than meddling, they love to meddle and act like they are still this, you know, globe bestriding power.
They still think it's 1903. Yes.
Yeah, given by their rhetoric around Ukraine and elsewhere, it's just, it's like, chill, people. Like, when the Ukraine war started, the head of the British Land Forces told Parliament they could not hope to field an armored division to Europe until 2030 at the earliest. I mean, this is insane. This is, they're talking an extremely big game, and it's not caught up to them that, I mean, it's one of my favorite things you ever wrote when you adjusted for purchasing power parity and differences in regional pricing and things, and you're like, the UK would be the poorest state were it to become a state on a per capita basis. You know, it's sort of wild. It's sad.
That's become even more. It's even worse since I wrote that article the first time. I recently updated it, and the UK is near the bottom still. And in fact, the quote unquote the Financial Times ran an article about it about 18 months ago, and it now has a phrase. They call it the Mississippi question. The question is, at what point does the UK become poorer than the poorest U.S. state, which is Mississippi? And the UK is down there. It depends on how exactly you do the measure, but the UK is maybe between West Virginia and Mississippi, maybe below every U.S. state. That's how far the United Kingdom has fallen. Now, that doesn't apply to Europe overall, because Europe, most of Europe, continental Europe, is not as poor as the UK. The UK is one of the sick men of Europe. And you can look to other countries that are far better off. I mean, the Germans are considerably, Germany falls like kind of in the bottom quarter of the U.S. in terms of comparisons to other states. And then, of course, the Swiss are doing pretty well. The Norwegians are doing pretty well. And there are several countries in the north that are doing pretty well. The U.K. is not among them. The U.K. is not a country that is doing well. It's not building wealth. It doesn't have a growing economy in terms of laying the groundwork for future capital accumulation. So it's just rapidly becoming an irrelevant country. But it does, as George Orwell might have pointed out, right, when he called the U.K. Airstrip One, it does function as a convenient military installation location for the United States. Which is so greatly eclipsed the UK that, I mean, this is just ancient history at this point. The last time the UK could claim to be a power anywhere even near rivaling the United States. So it's all about the US and State of Israel and Iran, and they all come to the US and lobby the US because that's what matters still. In spite of all of our problems, which you rightly pointed, we can't really afford to keep doing this stuff, given the social degradation in the United States. The U.S. keeps doing it because if you can just get a small percentage of all of that sweet, sweet American taxpayer loot, you can do all sorts of stuff in other parts of the world. So we better wrap up with that for this episode of Radio Rothbard. Thank you, Zachary Yost, for coming on and discussing some of these troubling trends with the Trump administration. I hope our more happy predictions come actually true, but I wouldn't bet any money on it at this point. Nonetheless, we'll be back next week with more here on Radio Rothbard, and we'll see you next time. One last thing, Radio Rothbard listeners, I want to make sure and mention our upcoming event in Phoenix, Arizona. That is April 26th. The Mises Institute will be in Phoenix, Arizona, as we expose the dangers and the waste and the downright evil that is our federal bureaucracy. We'll have some of our top speakers there, specifically Dr. Robert Malone, Tom Woods, and Tom DiLorenzo will all be there to discuss various aspects of our bureaucratic overlords. Tickets are $100 for Mises members and $120 for non-members. You can register now at Mises.org/Phoenix25. And by the way, there was a Radio Rothbard podcast raffle, and the winner of that is Mark Thompson. So, Mr. Thompson, stay tuned. You will hear from someone from the Mises Institute who will confirm your ticket to the event. And, of course, we thank everyone who participated in the raffle. And, of course, we at the Institute hope to see you on April 26th. And we'll be back next week with more here on Radio Rothbard.